Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Madeline Thien, author of Do Not Say We Have Nothing. Her third novel, published this month by Norton and currently shortlisted for the Man Booker Award. Madeline was born in Vancouver. Her story collection is Simple Recipes, and she has also written Certainty and a wonderful, wonderful book, all of them are, Dogs at the Perimeter. So since 2010, she's also been part of the international faculty at the MFA program at City University of Hong Kong. So, Do Not Say We Have Nothing. First, and usually somewhat daunting to me and other readers, there is a family tree, which sometimes elicits a bit of a shudder for me. But this family tree is seamless and informative from the outset, and a few flipping back and forths and you have a pretty good idea of the cast of characters. So in brief summary, testing myself, there's Big Mother Knife, who's a boisterous and matriarchal leader of a frequently fractured and torn asunder family. Her husband, Ba Lut, is equally boisterous and full of strength, but at least superficially a different way. Then there's Swirl, Big Mama's sister, who's a lovely woman, whose life is torn apart, as are many in the book and millions in real life, by Mao's cultural revolution. Her husband is Wen the Dreamer, who brings love, romance, and the Book of Records, an unfinished series of notebooks around which much of the novel flows. Swirl's previous life before Wen is tragic in many ways, and you'll see that in the book. Big Mama and Ba Lut have three kids, Dashan and Flying Bear, who are again both boisterous and good at heart. Their third son forms a part of one of the two groupings in the book. This is Sparrow, an accomplished composer. His cousin Zhu Li is a virtuoso violinist whose true heart is her music, and she doesn't waver from that. And his best friend is Jiang Kai, another gifted musician, a pianist whose path is somewhat different. Sparrow's daughter Ai Ming and Jiang Kai's daughter Marie, or her anglicized name, together work to piece together the past and try to make sense of tragedy, heroism, and a society torn asunder by the efforts of one man and the cult of his personality that led to a conflagration of epic proportions. So maybe that is a mouthful, but it all slides together and forms, through the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, a seamless whole that, as we do our work, and she makes us do a lot of work, creates a picture of a world that is gone but must be remembered. So welcome, Madeline, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I usually don't like to break down the fourth wall of my broadcasts, but since Marie is a mathematician, I have to make an exception. Today, you're shortlisted for the Man Booker. Congratulations.
Sure.
So on October 25th, you'll know whether you won or lost, but this won't be broadcast until November 7th. So right now, I kind of look at you as Schrodinger's cat. You've neither won nor lost the Man Booker Award. So how does it feel to have won or not won the award?
That is beautiful. I have never been Schrodinger's cat before, so I'm in the cardboard box. And it's a great question because it makes me think, do I have any control over this destiny, or am I destined to be the cat? And fate will decide if I'm there or not there.
But it is interesting because it actually posits the problem in real life. You are both right now.
I'm both a particle and a wave.
We should do the slit experiment and see what happens. You might get splattered, though. So anyway, so what I was saying was, you really, you know, you make the reader work hard, which I love. So for example, I had to try to figure out whether the continued fraction of the square root of d is periodic. Do I really want to do that? No. But it's, but I had to do it. And then there's lots of Chinese poetry. You have to deal with the Goldberg variations, Bach, Shostakovich, the Erhu, which I went to YouTube, and I ended up watching like six things and ending up listening to the 12-girl band.
And that's great.
And then you have to kind of learn a little bit of Mandarin, Cantonese, simplified Chinese, Chinese musical notation, and the different ways you can interpret the word way. So then you have to go look up Li Menchu's Slapping the Table in Amazement, which I did. And then there's, if I'm pronouncing it right, Mencius, the Chinese philosopher, which I had never heard of. And then luckily I'm back on solid ground with Dostoevsky and Schoenberg and Allegro Risoluto, but then I had to look up Paul Hindemith. So why are you making me do all this work?
Well, I love that you looked everything up. I think that is extraordinary. And it's like, isn't it? I have the feeling that inside the novel are sort of countless miniature doors that you could slip through. And they're all sort of just ajar. You know, you can walk through them or you don't need to walk through them, but they're each shedding a bit of light on the world of the novel.
Well, the thing is that because they are ajar, and that because of, for good or for bad, the internet, I really can go anywhere, and revisiting the Goldberg variations, and revisiting, or just learning about the erhu. How do you pronounce the musical instrument?
Erhu.
Yeah.
Yes, you're very close. You're just right, erhu. And I don't know if you stumbled across these. There's some incredible YouTube videos of people using the erhu, which is in the Chinese temperament, in the Chinese tuning, the pentatonic scale, to play Western classical music. So they play Bach on the erhu and so on, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, the sound is so different, but then so evocative at the same time.
Yes, it's very much like a singing voice. It has a lot of color. It's a moving voice. It always feels like it's like a lone voice singing to you.
How come there's five horizontal lines between the sections?
This is the beautiful imaginative work of the designer, and they had it. I think initially the idea was that my language is deserting me. The musical notation, what is that called? Where you put the staves on the lines of music?
Oh.
What is that called?
All I can think of is the G clef that begins it. The staff? Not.
Yeah, it's, oh my gosh, my brain. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
I didn't move that leg, but that's what it was supposed to be, reminiscent of bars of music.
Now I understand exactly.
But without the notes, interestingly. So in some ways it's about the unwritten music, or about the silence, or about the what's about to be written, and so on.
It's the way you've divided the book, too. I mean, you know, to have a section that's called zero, you know.
Yes, part zero.
Yeah.
The point on which all other points depend.
My daughter and I were talking about zero the other day, and I was talking with one of her little friends. She's 15, but her little friend, who was 8 years old, and she was trying to explain to me the importance of zero, and she's 8 years old, and she was trying to explain how there's only nine numbers, and if you didn't have a zero, that's all you would have.
That's right.
So.
And we use it instinctively, you know, ground zero, year zero. They have a catastrophic change and moments at which there's no return. The concept of zero in our culture is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose then to move down one, Marie and her cousin, or Li Ling and her cousin, essentially being the ground from which you move back upward a generation, back to the Cultural Revolution? Why not just write a novel in which we're in the here and now, but in the 70s and 80s?
Mm-hmm. I think because part of the structure of the novel is about return and repetitions, and using the structure of the Goldberg variations, of the simple motif that begins and then gets reworked in different ways, even though that cellular structure, that those five or six notes that are the building blocks of the rest of the variations, returns, and we hear it in increasingly complex ways. So part of the movement of the novel, and starting with Li Ling, is, or Marie as we call her, is to allow that simple motif of the child and the stranger who comes into her life, and that repeats and repeats in different ways, both backwards in time and forwards in time. So she, in some ways, is the zero point. But you could also say that the zero point is 1989 Tiananmen Square, and it allows for, in a way, a prismatic moment when we see a culmination of 20th century Chinese history. And if we work backwards from the present, it is the zero point for the China that we know today.
I guess if you look at the world, depending on your worldview, we kind of live in a fugue state universe, or a Fractalized universe, or a Mandelbrot set universe.
Mm-hmm. I love that you bring in Mandelbrot. Mm-hmm.
But it's true, though, you know? We don't have the perspective. Well, that's what you did. You created perspective, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great... nobody has said this to me before. I like this. I almost want you to expand on it. It's a beautiful concept.
I can't. I have to ask the questions.
Well, you know, with Mandelbrot and the idea of the fractal, that too is, I think, structurally informs this book. One of my favorite writers is the science writer James Gleick.
And oh, I'm going to interview him.
He
has a new book.
Oh, he's just brilliant. And he references one of my books, apparently. Someone told me I haven't got to that point yet.
Really?
Yeah.
And his new book about time travel?
Yes, time travel.
Wow.
Yes, I'm a huge fan of his.
Me too.
And he had written to me after he read my novel, and I was so just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was a beautiful thing. But I love all his books, and Chaos really changed my life. And this idea of the fractal, of the repetition of the pattern, of the return, except that even though we know that it returns, the repetition is never quite the same. So it's like, yes, it comes back, and we still see the shape, like in broccoli or in a leaf or in all the fractal patterns around us, or in a tree, but the repetition is never exact, and the potential for difference is infinite.
Once when I was in my teens, and I may or may not have been in a somewhat semi-altered state of mind, I realized that we were always in the middle of everything. And I could see these patterns that transverse the infinite. And I realized, hey, I'm just like this little tiny thing that's not even a tiny thing, right in the middle of all this. And no matter where I move, I'll still be in the very, very middle of it. And I think that, I don't think that as a human being, you ever really can honestly grasp that. But I think that just like when you wrote about Cambodia, and here you're writing about the Cultural Revolution, or you could have been writing about the Holocaust, or so many other things that men somehow are able to do to other men, you know, and then we have to watch out for it happening again.
Yes, and it is doomed to repeat, even though we know the history, we seem...
You're too young to actually believe it, I think.
It's sad, and it's one of the most distressing.
It is.
Facets of living is when you get to that point, and you think we are going to come back here again and again, and we are going to have people who note that and try to articulate what it is that we've returned to again and again, and those voices too will return, and it's part of how we're all bound up together. Yeah, I know what you mean. The tragedy is so immense, and at the same time, the possible joys are so immense. It's very difficult to live with this dichotomy. And I loved what you said about always being in the middle, and I think one of the reasons I love fiction and literature is that it gives you the chance to not... to step outside of that middle, to dissolve the self in really powerful ways. We lose ourselves in the fictional worlds as we make them and as we read them. And maybe that's our best chance of stepping outside of that middle.
Well, especially as you said, if you leave the doors ajar, you've not only created a novel, but you've created a kind of wormhole. You love talking about this stuff, but you've created like a wormhole universe.
Mm-hmm. So. And I do think that is how great literature, or the literature we that lives in us for a long time, exists. It's like a honeycomb, you know, like all the light is coming through, and I think a really extraordinary novel is never closed in on itself. it's always sort of conscious of being part of the library of books, of being part of, it's in conversation, because it can't hold the universe within itself, so it has to have the doorways to the other, you know, to the other universes and to that wormhole.
Hey, I just thought of something. Will your publicist get upset that we're not trying to sell your book and I haven't asked you yet what your book is about?
I hope not. I feel like, you know, that this is the kinds of conversations I really love. And I love that the book makes it possible. And also, not just this book, but all the books that we're bringing to thinking about this book. I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
one review, so since at least I'm going to a review, one review says that all your characters are kind of like good guys. And I feel the same way. Everybody, there may be flaws in each of them, and there certainly are, but they're all good people that you predominantly represent in your book as protagonists or characters. Did you feel like it took that in order to not level the playing field, but to kind of make up for the fact that everything they're railing against and fighting for and being and succumbing to is so great that your characters had to be good almost?
I'm not sure they are all good.
Tell me who's not.
I think Kai is, for me, very complicated, and I think maybe one of the reasons we don't...
He's complicated.
It's not that he's not good. It's just that in this kind of catastrophe, like something like the Cultural Revolution, in which so many people were targeted, so many people could become the enemy, so much was said in public and done in public in a way to protect oneself, that good and bad, good and evil don't resonate in the same way, because everyone is ordinary in a sense, and everyone does the ordinary thing, which is they just try to get by. They just try to live their lives, and along the way they make many, many compromises. So in some senses the fulcrum of good and not good is useful, but there's a limitation, because even the good, and here we're talking about Kai, which I think maybe many readers might agree with you that he is good, but complex. And I would have to ask, was he good? He put himself first in every instance. He tried to protect what he could protect, but he thought that in saving this outlet for himself, the ability to make music, to perform music, to express what music is capable of expressing, he could protect some of that goodness. But in the end, that too is destroyed. And maybe even worse, he does it with his own hands. You know, and it's not taken from him the way it's taken from the president of the Shanghai Conservatory, or even taken from Sparrow or Julie. He gives it. He gives it over. And that, I think, on our scale of goodness is something we don't know. We maybe don't have the language for. I'm not sure it's still in the realm of the good, though.
It's funny, because if he was in the real world, Western civilization, when he begins to flirt with Zuli, mm-hmm. You can see, like, right away, since I am one, he's a narcissist. but you know, he's like a good guy, and in the United States, you know, he might make some compromises in his life, but I still feel like at the bottom he would probably do the right thing.
And maybe this is where we diverge, and I have this, I think it's a Dawkins quote from ages and ages ago, and it says, you know, let us try to teach altruism because we are not born good. And I'm probably completely misquoting him, but that's the way I've remembered the quote. And it's something that I really felt when I was writing about the Cambodian genocide, the war, you know, America's involvement in Vietnam and in Cambodia and Laos, and also now writing about China, is this assumption of our goodness is so powerful that sometimes we don't acknowledge when we are acting destructively on the world.
Do you feel like that, since your writing does go back to the East, do you think that someday you'll write a book that deals with, and I, you may already have, that deals solely with, you know, say, relations between, when you, like when the part where you talk about the amnesty that Ai Ming can obtain, which, can you imagine trying to get that now? The amnesty that she obtains, something like that, something about the journey of a girl between Canada and America and all the things she encounters on that trip.
I do foresee that. Yeah, I think the novels are moving, and I think it's a really interesting question, because I think one of the conceptual frameworks I've brought into the writing of this book and the last one is that the binary of East and West is in our heads, and that the histories are so intertwined and have been intertwined for a very, very long time, but there is some need in the cultures to separate us as if there's a wall dividing us. And even though we know that the movement of goods, the flow of goods, the movement of religion, ideas, philosophies, paper, writing, all of these things have always flowed back and forth, and yet we had this idea that we've come from two different seeds almost, you know. And
yeah.
And then one of the places that I most love, and I'm so glad to have been able to spend time, is a place called Dunhuang, which is an old city on the Silk Road. And in the caves of Dunhuang were these 50,000 documents that were hidden away, and date back to the 6th century, 7th, 8th, and so on, and even further back, I think. And the languages of these documents are amazing. It's like Sanskrit and it's the old, it's the language of Jesus. It's the, what is this language?
Aramaic?
Old Syrian, Aramaic, yes. I think it's countless how many languages are on these pieces of paper.
Well, that's
the incredible movement that is so old and always went along with trade and so on, and religion.
That's what brings me to, like, I think what you did was courageous in a way by actually, you know, from time to time in the book, we encounter Chinese characters, both in Mandarin and Cantonese and in simplified Chinese, and then you interpret them and say, okay, if there's a door inside this character, then that means, and that's another way in which you make the reader work really hard, and but it's very productive. But do you
I think it's very productive, yes. Well, you know, because we take for granted the frameworks of our language. So we have certain ways of expressing things in English that are part of our ways of seeing the world. And one of the interesting things is about time. You know, we're very future-oriented in the English language. We look towards the future. The past is behind us. That's completely different in Chinese, where tomorrow or the day after, tomorrow is the day behind, and yesterday is the day ahead, because it's what you can see. So, or consciousness, you know, in the Western conceptual language, we rise up, like we wake up and we fall asleep. In Chinese, you move, it's lateral, it's a lateral plane, not a vertical one. So you're always on a vertical plane that moves between consciousness and subconsciousness. We move towards awaking, we move backwards, or not backwards, but, you know, to the left or somewhere. I don't even know how to express it in English.
Well,
and I love this, because it makes us note what we take for granted about the way we see the world.
Well, you sound like someone who's just read James Gleick's time travel book. It's like it has.
Well, this one is at Perry Link. Perry Link is this wonderful Chinese, he knows Chinese languages and literature, and he has an incredible book about the Chinese language.
What's that called, so I can write it down?
Oh, gosh, what is it called? I think I've referenced it. He's got so many wonderful books.
What's his name?
Perry Link. He's got a wonderful book called Evening Chats in Beijing, which is about, he goes and speaks to intellectuals and scholars and people in Beijing at a time of change in the 80s. And but the one about language, the title is escaping me.
I'll find it.
Yes, it's wonderful. It's a great book.
Well, speaking of language, and as I said, it is a thread that runs through the entire book and to a certain extent controls events, is the Book of Records. And then when I tried to do my homework and look up the Book of Records, there is no Book of Records, is there?
You're right.
Damn.
Well, there are many potential, like,
candidates.
The Book of Records. So there's the old historical records of Sima Qian. There's also the very famous Chinese novel, Dream of the Red Chamber. And it's unknown how many chapters this book actually has, because the author died before the book was completed. And there were just these hand-copied manuscripts that he'd given to friends. And in the manuscripts, there were also the comments of the readers, the marginalia. And so the study of the margin notes and the text is called Redology, Dream of the Red Chamber. So it's a field of study, Redology. And later on, someone else came forward and said they had more chapters of the book, an extra 40 chapters. So no one actually knows what is the original, what are the additions and permutations. And you can buy, different kinds of editions of the Dream of the Red Chamber. Some have 70 chapters, some have 110, and so on and so forth.
I had a woman who worked in my bookstore who got her master's degree in marginalia. And the only thing I said to her is, what exactly do you plan to do for employment now?
Yeah, really.
It's fascinating. And she was always in the rare book room with linen gloves, looking at things that maybe perhaps Edgar Allan Poe had written in the margin of Confessions of an Opium Eater or something like that, which must have been fascinating. But I don't know what your livelihood would be thereafter.
I wouldn't know either, but I love that she's being so attentive to that. You know, it's almost like a transcript of a conversation between writer and reader. It's a beautiful thing.
It's funny because the Book of Records is like the way we were talking before about things repeating themselves. It's like, especially in a certain part of the book, without spoiling it, where certain changes are made to the Book of Records in order to lead someone to a place. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the Book of Records is another it is. It's two other characters in the book, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you think of that device, although that kind of demeans it a little bit, but how did you think of the entire device of the Book of Records?
It initially simply just started as a book that takes its readers away. It allows them to escape, but in the escape, they recognize these fragmented pieces of these themselves. I remember when I published my first book, it was a collection of short stories, and it's not autobiographical, but I borrowed little bits and pieces, and my sister said something that always stayed with me. She said it's like knowing her own life, but then seeing it reflected in a kind of broken mirror. And I feel like the Book of Records acts as a broken mirror for these characters, in which they catch a glimpse of themselves, but it's not cohesive in that way, or it's not meant to reflect them entirely. It's meant to capture what it can. And in that mix of the fragment is that they're fragmented with others, you know, because these historical events are distorting and expanding and overturning and changing and illuminating the lives of everyone around them in the same moment. And it becomes the keeper of unofficial history, because China, the keeping of history is fraught, the keeping of the record of history is so fraught, and sensitive events like the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, the 1989 demonstrations, they have been extremely distorted in the official Book of Records. So literature, art, music, even mathematics, they become ways to hold the internet, you know, algorithms, everything becomes a way to hold the unofficial Book of Records.
And it actually seems like those are the things that fascinate you in real life, too.
Very much. The messiness of it. You know, and it's where for fiction is so powerful. It's still, for me, the novel is a very young form historically. And so I feel like what we can do with it is exciting, how we can bring as much of the world into it as possible, but also retexturize it, allow us to hear it in a new way, to see it when we've become blinded to what's right in front of us in the reality. It gives us a chance to see it anew, to really look at it, to really dwell in it in a way that the present moment always seems to be escaping us.
It's funny because I didn't realize until I thought tried to think not like a Westerner, but when people are copying the Book of Records, it's almost as if it's a creative act, because the copies contain, I can't even figure it out, they contain new information, and of course the calligraphy is dependent on the individual. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard for me to articulate what exactly is changing.
Yes, that's so beautiful. I think that's something the book meditates on in and out now and again. And
it does.
Because we live in a culture where we highly prize the original. You know, the genius is the original. This idea that there is such a thing as a new thought. And in some ways, the book plays with this idea that we are repeating the thoughts, that the thoughts are returning and returning and taking on different shapes and different forms. And we become ourselves in strange ways through the act of copying. We copy to learn a way of expression or a way of thinking. And in the devotional act of copying, we discover some essence of ourselves that is both part of the copying and the original.
And see,
but we don't try to say that they're not connected.
And the difference is, in the Western world, people either are too lazy or there's not enough time to do that act. You don't have time to copy, and you don't have the rigor necessary to copy. Mm-hmm. At least, I'm speaking of myself personally, but and generalizing. But I think
you're right. Even though we know, from say the artistic masters and the old atelier and Michelangelo and so on, a lot of the studio work was about copying first, right? But you learn to draw on the hand of the master, and then you become the artist. But you mentor, you apprentice, and this is true in music as well. You apprentice for a long time, and then in doing that, you discover what is free inside yourself, and what can be spoken after you've acquired all this technique.
And in the book, and what we haven't really touched upon, is the concept of being called before a committee, and watching your friends or relatives being killed while you're there, and then perhaps sent to a re-education camp. And that's why the one section where they're all sleeping in the long bed, and the translator, who you end up calling Dostoevsky, who seems like a supremely good person, right? She is, right?
Yes.
So it's so strange to feel that I don't know how I could survive in that kind of situation. And it changes Swirl completely, but it doesn't destroy her. And the same with Wen as well. And I think part of your book is really about that, because, as I said in the introduction, we're talking about these 10 or 12 people, when in actuality, if it's to believe, you're talking about 10 million people who were destroyed and whose families also had to live with that destruction as well. It's almost inconceivable.
That's right. And I think I've thought a lot about what it means when something is inconceivable or unimaginable, or we feel we can't go there. I felt this a lot when I wrote about Cambodia and the Cambodian genocide. You do reach the point at which you know that language will fail you, that there is a point that you cannot pretend to understand. And at the same time, we use that word incomprehensible, inconceivable. This is a word that's often used with the Cambodian genocide, a kind of madness. We almost run to that word. It was an act of madness. And that absolves us from trying to understand the very real mechanisms that we can understand, the step-by-step process that leads to the demonization of a group of people or a class of people or an ethnicity of people, and then gives the license to destroy them, to destroy their world, their lives, their ideas, and their person, their bodies. And in fact, it is not, I think what is difficult for people to accept it is it's not unimaginable, because every step along the way, it seems rational. It's all a series of tiny steps that lead to what we call madness, but every step along the way appears to be rational or appears to grow from something that came before and allows the next step to be taken. And that's how society gets pushed into very dangerous territory where you've taken many, many small steps to dehumanize. And the violence that is then that one is then becomes capable of, even ordinary people, becomes readily accessible.
And unfortunately, you've just described America at this very moment, at the day we're talking.
Indeed, yeah, I have, yes.
And then it's like, if you look at, well, it hasn't yet happened here, and hopefully because our Constitution and our democracy has been so flexible for, well, again, in terms of Asia, not a long time, but a relatively long time for a Western country, we haven't seen it happen yet, and hopefully we won't. But if you look at Syria, for example, now, mm-hmm. the madness that you've described is in full-blown swing, and Americans get to pause every once in a while when they show us a picture of a little boy who's sitting there dazed with blood coming down his face. Mm-hmm. But we only stop for that moment, and then that meme goes around the internet for a week, and then it goes away. So what do you think? You seem, like I said, so sober for someone so young. So what do you think, is there anything you can do individually? And we talked about that, are we greater than, you know, ourselves? Is there anything that we can do now that can, like, forestall what's happening in other parts of the world? Or can we just watch it and comment on it?
I do think there are things we can do, but I do think of primary importance is we need to educate ourselves. And if the systems around us are failing to educate us, we need to take it into our own hands. And I think when it comes to Syria, the geopolitics of the Middle East is something that is now, that is part of our histories, all of our histories, Canada, the U.S., and so on. And we have been engaged and involved, and we are implicated, and it's not just since yesterday. And I think we need that knowledge so we can think about how to act, how to respond, and to take responsibility, because it's not Syrians doing this to themselves. There's a whole geopolitics in play, and there are a lot of it's the proxy war. It is a proxy war, just like Lebanon was a proxy war and Cambodia was a proxy war. We have to realize that we are in this up to our necks, and the bombs are not falling on us, but we are implicated.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult situation, complicated by, I almost squared by the situation in America today, and trouble. You know, I spend a good portion of my day thinking about this now, which I didn't. Just like I didn't plan on spending 30 minutes on the internet trying to find the Book of Records, I didn't plan on the idea of spending half of my day thinking about what the heck is going on in this country right now. So it was.
And it's a terrible. I mean, maybe I'm wrong to say this, but in some ways, it's the level of the conversation around what's happening in the U.S. now is not going very deep, and it's acting as a distraction from some serious issues that need to be addressed, and some serious inequities. And you know, and I say this, I'm a Canadian, we have this too. We have huge historical wounds here that we don't have the patience or the energy or the bravery to talk about. So we tend to talk about politics in a very superficial level.
Incredibly.
Devolve into spectacle, or you know, really silly things, and it absolves us again from having to take responsibility.
It's funny, I have this nonfiction book club at our bookstore, and there's like 25 people in it, and everybody's, you know, very nice and civilized, but there's one person out of, and the way I look at it is because they're all educated, they shouldn't be for Trump, but there's one person who is for Trump. And I can see what you're talking about as madness happening to me. I don't want to talk to her anymore. Mm-hmm. I feel like there was a part of me that said, you know, I'd like to kick her out of the book club. Mm-hmm. And it's like, those are the little steps that polarize people. Who am I to say that, you know?
You're completely right. And in fact, one of the things that is very very clear when I was looking at Cambodia and China, we should be very afraid when the middle ground begins to disappear, when it becomes so polarized on both sides, and the people speaking in the middle, their voices are drowned out, or they become the targets of attack. We are now in very scary territory, because if the middle ground disappears, we are heading towards violent confrontation.
Then, like in Rwanda, not only does the middle ground disappear, but everything in the middle blurs. So the person who you're hacking the arms off with the machete might not even be the person you think it is.
That's right. And the people who tried to protect, like Hutu who tried to protect Tutsi and so on, they were really considered the enemy, you know, even more. It's like the enemy within. On the road to the totalitarian state is a huge fear of the enemy within, and that can be the immigrant, the migrant, the laborers, the, you know, African Americans. It can be something that becomes the repository of some sort of fear or this idea that they can be blamed for the scapegoating, you know, that they can be blamed for whatever crisis or trauma the nation is going through.
We can't begin to end this interview talking about six different genocidal events. It's too depressing. It'll ruin the rest of my day. So we should talk.
Right.
We should talk about the music in the book. And the book is imbued. You know, it's driven by its music, and it's so funny how it's Western music that drives all these people towards their respective goals. And I wonder why that is too.
Reasons. Western classical music has such a fascinating history in China. The first clavichord was brought into China by Jesuit missionaries. They carried many musical instruments, hoping that they could tempt the emperor to receive the gifts, and thus they could be allowed into the Forbidden City. And one of the famous Jesuit missionaries, Matteo Ricci, he actually was buried just outside the gates of the Forbidden City. He wasn't allowed in, but he waited his whole life to have that access. But over time, they were allowed in, and they were allowed to open schools in the interior of China, and one of the things that was taught always was music. So that's one way Western classical music entered. Another is refugees. Shanghai was a place you didn't need a passport to enter in the 1930s and part of the 40s, I think. But prior to that, refugees from Russia or from the revolution had come into China, and some made their living by teaching music, teaching the violin, and later on Jewish refugees from Europe arrived in Shanghai. Similar story. So it's interwoven into all of our histories again and into Chinese history. And I think for the musicians, particularly composers like Beethoven, spoke to a revolutionary time, to a transitional time, to a kind of romanticism, idealism, but also the complexity of what that could mean, and a kind of the first stirrings of dissonance in the harmony. You know, so that I think all that spoke to the Chinese musicians, but my musician in particular, the composer Sparrow, he's a bit out of tune with the times, and his love is for Bach. His love is for counterpoint, polyphony. And he understands what he thinks he loves about Bach is the freedom within the constraint. So there's such strict counterpoint that Bach works with, and yet he creates these universes of feeling. And Sparrow lives in a time of constraint, and in Bach he sees a possibility of how to be free even in those limitations.
And several times in the book, both with Sparrow and with the two other musicians, there's moments in which, and you do it in a really magical way, which I really admire, is that they're lost. You describe the idea that they're so lost in the music that they kind of no longer exist, that they are the music.
Yeah.
And as a non-musician, I can't, you've made me understand that a lot better than I ever could. But But that's what you're conveying. I mean, you, it really is. It's not meditative. It's almost ecstatic. But it's also, you can't help it. It's just what happens.
Yes, and they understand something because of the kind of music they're working with. They understand the music came before they were born, was written before they were born, and the music will outlast them. And in their lives, it's this brief singing, performing. That they take it into themselves, but they're more conscious of the fact that they themselves are the passing thing, and the music continues after they're gone.
Well, this was a pleasure talking to you, and one of the nicest things was the idea that you and I are on the same page, almost literally, with regard to James Glick and his new book, and the fact that I'm so envious of you that he wrote to you about your novel. Isn't that amazing?
That was ecstatic for me. I just couldn't believe it. I
did you get an email, or did you actually get a letter, or?
He sent me a note on Twitter.
Oh, that was so nice.
And then a message, and we had a few back and forth messages, but I hadn't known that he was referencing the my book at all, an earlier book. That has a lot to do with the Mandelbrot set. and then, did I send him the... No, he went and he got the book before it was published in the U.S. because for a long time we couldn't find a U.S. publisher, and he went and somehow got a copy from the U.K. It just moved me so much.
It's so funny that I mentioned it, too. And it's so funny that in all my YouTube wanderings around your book, somehow I ended up with... You know how they have all those different YouTube videos of the Mandelbrot set unfolding and the fractal...
Yes.
And I loved, I'm mesmerized by watching those. But how I got to that from your book, I don't know.
There's a great one you should look for. It's Bach. Bach's, it's one of the fugues. And it's if you look for Bach Möbius strip, it's the unending Bach fugue. It's one of the most beautiful YouTube videos ever.
I'll look it up. And you know what I just realized? You and I probably have read Gadel Escher Bach and Eternal Golden Bread.
Absolutely.
And all of Douglas Hofstadter stuff.
Yes, wow, brilliant.
Well, there is, you know, this goes back to the book, and I know I'm keeping you, but just the idea that, you know, between Escher and Bach and Kurt Gödel, and this idea of the fugue and this idea of the Mandelbrot set, it really is funny how all those different arts and sciences converge upon one another.
Yes.
Which reminds me of my altered state dream.
Yes. I have a lot of sympathy for that. I've seen some of the things you've seen, and it's an extraordinary thing to feel. And then you have it always. You remember it always. It's that underlying structure of things.
Well, I could talk to you all day about all this because it sounds like we have a lot of interest in common. But
yes.
And I know you got all kinds of things to do. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Really, it's a great pleasure.
Okay, I hope to talk to you soon.
Me too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Madeline Thien, who is the coolest ever, and talking to us about her new book, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, which is, I don't know how we got on math and music. Well, music's in the book, but I don't know how we got on math. And the fugue and Mandelbrot set and fractals, but those are all things I'm fascinated with. And James Glick's new book, who I hopefully am going to be interviewing, is called Time Travel, and it's fascinating as well. It starts out with H.G. Wells and first coming across the concept of, he rode a stationary bike, and he came across the idea of, well, stationary bike, I'm static in space, but I'm moving through time. That's neither here nor there. Anyway, so she's a lovely woman. She has a lovely voice, doesn't she? And her book is great, and her past books are really great as well. A lot of people have told me it's their favorite books, some of what she's written. And so anyway, I would highly recommend that book. And what we have coming up is We have Armando Lucas Correa. He discusses his latest novel, The German Girl. And just in time for Thanksgiving, we have food writer and researcher Elaine Kosarova, who will share her fascinating new book, Butter, A Rich History, which will tell you as much as you possibly want to know about butter and perhaps a little bit more than you want to know about butter, but it's excellent. And it's like one of those books, like when I interviewed the guy, I remember, who did cod and salt, and the other one who did paper and the pencil. There's these commodities that we think nothing about, yet without them we wouldn't be able to go around our day-to-day lives. And butter is one of those things. Like, we just reach for it and slice it, put it on your baked potato, put it on your bread, put it on your English muffin, but you don't ever think about what it is or where it came from. And this book really does that, plus it includes all kinds of weird and incredible recipes and recipes on how to make different types of butter. So in any event, we have lots more coming, and then we'll have our best of. And I thought of something, too, because I don't really have any way to figure out who's listening here, but come by the bookstore, tell me who my favorite author is, and I'll give you a $5 gift certificate. So if you come by Wellington Square Bookshop in Eagleview, and you tell me who my favorite author is, and my favorite author is James Joyce. So if you come by and tell me that, and don't tell your friends to come by, you have to be listening to the show. So you listen to the show, now you know my favorite author is James Joyce. Come by the store, say that, and get $5 off. And remember, Kathy Fortnoy at Chester County Books closed her store after 30-some years in a wonderful public service to the community. We get a lot of people now from there. Please, if you were an avid customer of Chester County Books, become an avid customer of Wellington Square Bookshop. And we'll also give you a $5 gift certificate if you say you've come from there. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we look forward to having you come by to listen next week.